Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk with me, Dan Clark. Oh, what a show we have for you today, guys. Our guest today is the wonderful Stephen Merchant, co-creator of The Office, Extras, Life's Too Short. He's a writer, director, actor, and a stand-up. Is there anything this man can't do and do successfully? He's even been a highly successful podcaster himself with the hugely popular shows that he did with Ricky Gervais and Cole Pilkington, which I always thought were fucking hilarious. He's someone whose work I've been a fan of for many years, and I've actually met him once or twice before, and he's always seemed like a really lovely guy, and which he is. Can you imagine if a chat show host or like a interviewer or someone introduced someone like, I've met this guy over the years and I've always got a bit of a bad vibe from him, but let's hope I don't get that today. Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest. But we had, Stephen and I had a brilliant conversation. It was funny and open and warm, and he has a brilliant guilty pleasure to talk about, which I hadn't seen, and I encourage you all to go and watch. But because the interview was so much fun and it overran and we've got to cut it down to fit the slot, I'm not going to do a news section or reviews or anything like that, but I will kickstart the show with a song. This is Karen O and the Kids with All Is Love, and this is from the film Where the Wild Things Are. Here we have my very special guest today, Mr. Stephen Merchant. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Dan.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Good.
My question is, how are you?
Is that the one question you have for this?
That's
whole...
That's it.
Yep. I'm okay, yeah. We're here in Los Angeles, which... do you still find, even though people know you work here and live here and stuff, when you go home and you say, oh, I've just been in Los Angeles, do people still sort of get a bit like, ooh, Los Angeles?
No, in fact, I think people assume I live here.
Right.
Now, cab drivers, well, you live in that Los Angeles, don't you? I mean, how they know what I'm doing, why they're following that, I don't know. But also, I feel like I'm by bicontinental in the sense that I feel like I go back and forth quite regularly and spend large chunks of time on either side.
You sleep with each continent.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I don't feel like I don't think I've ever admitted to myself that I live in LA.
Have you ever tweeted it? Because that's maybe how taxi drivers know.
I just feel like they just know. They just know where everyone is living.
They have the knowledge.
They expand internationally.
I mean, I find that when I come here and I go back home, if I ever say, oh, I've just come back from LA, people are like, ooh, LA. Like, you're showing off. And the weird thing is, if you actually showed off and said, oh, I've just been to this tropical island, like a privately owned island with just me and some close friends and served by beautiful people.
Yeah.
And all the money we spent went to an amazing charity. People would just go, oh, well, that sounds cool.
Right, right, right.
But LA.
Something about LA in particular.
Like you're all up yourself.
But I remember when I first moved to London from Bristol, I would go back and there'd be people in Bristol saying, oh, London, here he is, Mr. Fancy. What do you want to go to that London for? We got everything here. What have you got in London we ain't got? We got bowling. You want bowling? We got a bowling alley. We got all things. Yeah. So we're still, I think, wherever you go. I mean, you know, at the risk of beginning this conversation sort of sounding like I'm bad-mouthing England, which I'm not at all, and which is one of the reasons I have to go back as regularly as I can to get a nice feel of England and to kind of escape the la-la land of Hollywood.
Yeah.
But there is a part of England, and there's a certain British mentality that infects some people, which is that kind of... I don't know if it's jealousy, is it? It's hard for people to celebrate your... whether it's success or whether it's just travel or whether it's new experiences. Yeah, right.
Or even just trying. People are a bit like, oh, right, trying, are you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I always think people have said, like, what's the difference between American and England in their outlooks? And I always think, in America, if you're a kid and you say, I want to be president one day, people are like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
Shoot for the stars. And in England, if you went, I want to be prime minister, they'd be like, oh, he wants to be prime minister. Yeah. Good luck with that, mate.
Yeah, well, look where that's got the current hopefuls for the presidency.
Sure.
You know.
Well, there you are. That's it.
This is the one thing no one seems to be mentioning about Trump, is not about his policies or his outlook or anything, but just that some guy that's never been a politician is allowed to run for the most important job in the world.
Right.
Like, how is that? What? I suppose you just need the money here. That's all it.
I guess that's it. He's a success, right? He's a success in business, and so that's all you need.
It's amazing. Well, this isn't a political show, so we won't go in there. If it had been Ronald Reagan, then we could have discussed his lengthy film career prior to being a politician. Do you find, because you're working here a bit more, do you find it different to working back home? Do they both have, obviously, pluses and minuses?
Yes. I mean, there's one of the things that's appealing about Los Angeles is that it does often feel like a company town in that everyone is involved with the film and TV business or is aspiring to or is used to, you know, I mean, it's and therefore
people aren't ashamed as well to be saying that they're trying to do it.
No one's ashamed of the ambition of that.
No.
And it just, I think therefore it just means that sort of opportunity, you know, does lie around every corner, and that you do run into people and they do say, oh, I'm working on this, do you want to be involved with this? And that it's not, once you're here, the idea that you could have a meeting with Tom Hanks is not crazy in the way that when I was growing up in Bristol, that would have just seemed absurd. You know what I mean? Like, what universe do you think you live in that you could have a meeting with Ron Howard?
I would love it, though, if you, as a sort of 16-year-old, had tried to blag that.
Yeah, right,
yeah, at school.
Right,
oh, I've got a meeting with Tom Hanks this afternoon.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I think on the way here, I decided to get an Uber to your house, and first of all, the woman in the driver, it was a female driver, very, very beautiful female driver, which is not something you tend to get in London or the UK.
Sexist?
No, I just mean as it doesn't seem to be. I can imagine that you could pull that comment apart and find some sort of misogyny in there. But I'm just saying, from experience, it doesn't seem to be something that many women want to do as a job.
Right.
Probably down to safety, but also like sort of glamorous women as well.
No, right, know? Sure,
this
sure.
This was a woman
sure.
that was wearing kind of very glamorous clothing. And she said to me, what do you do? And I never like saying the performing part of what I do, because that comes with, what have I seen you in? Or if you say stand-up comedy, it's like...
Tell us a joke.
All that stuff. So I said, oh, I'm a writer. And she was like, oh, great, what kind of writing? I said, oh, TV comedy. And she said, comedy's funny.
Wow.
I was like...
That's a very LA comment. Yeah. I feel
like, wow. And then a bit later on she said, you know, I feel like I should watch more comedy, you know, because I don't laugh enough. And I'm like, wow, so the only time you'll ever laugh is when you're watching something with like you couldn't laugh in normal life.
Never laugh unless you're like, provoked by a well-scripted TV show that's got 12 people writing jokes.
I know, it's weird. So the 12 people thing, you had your own show on HBO a couple of years ago. Did you have a team of people?
Small team, yeah.
Small team. Smaller than your usual.
Small team in the sense that it was maybe five or six people as opposed to 12 or whatever you might find on a big network show. But great working with a team like that.
Yeah.
Really exciting, and you just feel like you're in a room with very smart people, and you throw up an idea and it kind of you know, pinballs around the room and develops, and or like a snowball, a lot of ball metaphors here, like it snowballs, you know, and it kind of builds and it gets, and that I really found exciting. And
was it weird at first though, having written either solely or with Ricky before,
right,
to suddenly like sort of like throw an idea that like it's your show and someone might go, I'm not sure about that, Steve, what about this? And
or but you know what it's like as a writer, I think that's the process. I there's no ego for me when I'm writing. Like I don't feel defensive about ideas or kind of embarrassed if someone doesn't like it, or there's not a question of sort of pulling rank, you know. So I like that. That's exciting to me. The kind of the dialectic, if you will, of the writing room, you know, all these different views kind of clashing together. I think what is important is that you remain very sort of firm in what the tone of the show is going to be, because otherwise it can start to get disparate, like all these different ideas, and it's and it's quite easy to spend hours just discussing things and never nailing anything down.
So your job is to be more like just making sure the vision is coming.
I'm very much the Donald Trump of the equation, you know. I've had some success. I'm calling the shots. I'm shooting from the hip.
You have a no Mexican policy on your staff, on your writing.
I've built a large wall. Everything is tremendous. It's going to be a tremendous show. We're full of tremendous talent.
You're going to make HBO great again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And and so I'm the sort of, you know, I'm the ringleader, but you know, I'm surrounded, I'm sure, as Trump is, by the best brains in the business.
I love that this interview is now going to be a comparison between Trump's career and yours.
Sure. Yeah.
You need to get yourself a really tall building in New York. Do you find that, you know, versus back home, which is, you know, you had a show which was incredibly British, your first big hit, and you've had many, but the first one. And there aren't actually many people, especially then, maybe more since then, but you guys were kind of the first that had a show that was successful in the US and got a adapted version that was successful.
Right.
You must have at one point thought, this can't get any better, can it? How have we done this? How have we done this?
Well, I think it was, again, looking back, every ambition that we had was very small in its scope. So
like just the next step.
Exactly. So it wasn't sort of a larger game plan.
Yeah.
It was just sort of, well, let's do this pilot of this show set in an office, and let's try and make that good, and let's make it kind of specific, and let's make it based on our own observations and experiences, and let's try and make it for people like us who will think this is funny or accurate.
Yeah.
And no sense that it would necessarily be popular even in England, except maybe to a small cult audience, you know. And then so that we tried that, and then that became inexplicably popular with a bigger audience, and then suddenly we find out that it's being passed around as a DVD, you know, in Hollywood, and that Samuel L. Jackson is watching it. Like, when is he watching? When is he sort of tearing the cellophane off of a DVD case and putting it in?
How did you know about this? Because this would have been pre-social media.
But I think what happened was Ricky obviously became pretty famous, and so would suddenly find himself at events or at junkets or making a film, and he'd meet these people and they would say, oh, I love your show, and then you'd find out that they'd seen it. And so, and then the America, they said, we'll make an American version. And the one thing that I felt I contributed to that was that, having been something of a fan and of the sort of folklore of movies and TV, I knew that there had been a lot of very unsuccessful attempts to remake British shows, and that it seemed to me that one of the flaws was when the original creators were too heavily involved in the American remake. Okay. And so they were just trying to replicate what they'd already done. And it seemed to me that the safer bet was to just let American, talented American people just do it, and not to meddle too much, and let them do their own thing. And ultimately that paid off. And so I think that was our one contribution, really, was to sort of be hands off and just offer what advice we could when it was needed.
And it seems to, well, it worked.
It worked, but again, hey, I remember literally having conversations with Ricky where we were saying, the chances of this American show succeeding, it's like winning the Olympics. Yeah. There are so many times beforehand where you might trip and break your ankle before you even get to the starting line. And then the idea that you win the gold, just crazy. So I just think our expectations were always kind of minimized, and therefore every degree that we went further, it was like, this is insane.
Yeah. And I like the fact that the British version was a very altered piece, and the American is the sort of the TV system that they did,
right,
and that they both work, you know, and they both kind of have a slightly different vibe because of that.
But you also see, when you work in both camps, you see the grass is always greener, because I speak to so many American writers who sort of are envious of the fact that British TV, they do a couple of series and then they end.
Yeah.
And then British people envious of the fact that American shows have bigger budgets and can run. So, everyone's always jealous of
what Americans mean is, we'd love to do it your way, but earn the same money we get.
Right, exactly. I don't know.
Did you find having a hit so early on in your career, did you find that a pressure at all? Like, you know, even though it was a hit in the best sense of the word, that it was a natural, you know, kind of word of mouth thing that turned into a huge commercial hit.
Right.
It wasn't like, you know, here's the keys to the kingdom, and you hadn't, you hadn't earned it or anything. But it's still like the pressure of, okay, we've just made.
I think we were probably aware of that. Although I think, I remember having conversations with Ricky, again, just my opinion was often formed, particularly then, based on, as I say, being something of a historian of other people's careers, and just knowing that it's almost impossible to top the success of something, particularly if it has had an impact in the way that show did, and that therefore you are safer to kind of try and do things sort of parallel to it, you know, or just go down different roads and not try and constantly...
Not chase the buzz.
Right, exactly. And I just think that way... madness lies, you know, because there comes a point at which, and I often think this when I see giant movie stars, you know, it's like, does Tom Cruise feel that pressure to sort of constantly make a film that's more successful or more impactful or more zeitgeisty than Top Gun was or Mission Impossible or whatever? And I guess
I love that you picked those two films of all the
right, but I suppose they're sort of markers, aren't they, in his career?
How hugely successful they were. And I think he does. Like,
well, I'm assuming he does, but clearly he's very good at that. Yeah. But I suppose for me, like, the people that I look at whose careers I admire and their work, whether it's Billy Wilder or Woody Allen and people, they're people that had as many hits as misses in a way, because they just kept trying to do stuff that was interesting to them. And perhaps it's the difference between approaching it as a writer and approaching it as a movie star, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think an actor has a different criteria, perhaps, than
You've
a writer.
You've got your,
writer.
Currency. You know, you're always worried about...
Who's snapping at your heels if you're a film star, right?
Yeah, and also, like, if your last film was not as much of a hit, will you get get more offers? And maybe in the world of directors, certainly kind of the Woody Allens or the sort of more independent filmmakers, you're not as worried about that. I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about Woody Allen recently because I had a conversation with a friend who's has this real fear of... I mean, we all do, but this person is... such a crippling fear of failure.
Yeah.
In case they somehow put a smudge on their canon of work.
Right.
And you think, there's actually quite a few people that we still think of as geniuses who have made quite a lot of duds.
Sure.
I mean, Woody Allen, he's sort of at the moment, it's like a 1 in 3 or something.
Right.
You know, it's... And again, I don't like bad mouthing.
But given that he's made a film a year since about 1969, I mean, you know, you're bound to have a couple of flaws in there. And I always make... I mean, one of the things which distresses me often is... And I mean, I use distress as a deliberate term because I'll read a sort of Martin Scorsese's lost it op-ed, you know, in some kind of broadsheet. Yeah. Like, how dare you, sir?
Yeah.
Like, what does this man have to do that he can't get a break? That he's lost it? Like, he's 70-something and he's... And I thought The Wolf of Wall Street was just one of the most kinetic, exciting, energized, funny films that I'd seen
like
in an age.
Someone compared it to, like, a sort of punk film. You know?
Yeah,
it
just was, a thrill. And you see these other people with, you know, who are half his age, who are making films less dynamic and exciting and thrilling. And I just think, you know, good luck. Long may he reign, you know. And I just, the idea, I think it's that thing again that I think a lot of people who look at the business from the outside, and I'm trying to sound here like an old sage, but I think and I remember thinking this as a, you know, again, as a fan and as a teenager, is you assume that there's a sort of game plan to every decision that someone you admire does, that somehow everything's a calculated move about what's the next step, what's the next revolutionary piece of work I'm going to do. This is all part of my master plan. And that actually, however successful you are, aside from perhaps the Tom Cruises, you sort of, you're going a little bit where the wind blows you, you know, you're... people will look at some of the, you know, the acting things I do and think like, why did he do that? And it's like, I did it because it was fun.
Yeah.
Because someone said, come and do this thing. And I thought, that'll be fun. And that, you know, selfishly, I'm sort of not doing it for your amusement. I'm doing it for mine, you know? And I think
that
more seriously
really
about
the...
out
of order, Steve. Right. Just bang out of order. These people, they've grown to trust you.
I know.
You know?
Right? But certainly the projects that I try and write and direct, I'm a bit more...
Well, also
judicious about, but in terms of acting, it's like
It's a sabbatical, isn't it?
It is. It's, you know, it's a day off from your real worries.
Well, you know, I always remember in probably the mid to late 90s, Nicolas Cage. Someone asking him, "Why do you make crap films now?" or something, and he was like, "Do you know what? I did a decade or 15 years of indie films, of films where I'm crying or freaking out. I just wanted to have some fun."
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and you kind of think, well, yeah, like if when you are about to go onto a shoot for 3 months, some actors must think, well, do I want to cry for the next 3 months or just kind of dick about?
Well, people, fans are obsessed with legacy.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, you know, oh, Robert De Niro, why isn't he making Taxi Driver? Because he made it when he was 30 and he cared and he had energy and he could give up whole swathes of his life to put on weight and lose weight. And now he's like an old man with you know, an art collection and wants
a film
to
festival to
run. He's got other things to do. It's like, give the guy a break.
Yeah.
You can still go and watch Taxi Driver. It still exists. It's still there.
I do love the idea of someone when, like, if Martin Scorsese makes a not great film, they go, I knew he was a fraud.
Right.
All those, that 20 other films, that was just luck.
But also, again, you know, and you see it so much on, I mean, I think Twitter and Instagram makes you very aware of how quick people are to judge. And you know, you'll make I'll make a kind of casual tweet that literally occurred to me walking from the kitchen to the lavatory, and then while sat on the lavatory, I'll make what I think is an amusing thought that occurred to me then. And there'll be some people that will LOL it, and there'll be many others that will be like, that's supposed to be funny. Yeah. It's a thought I had as I walked from one room to the next. It's not.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Just let it go. And people are so, you know, no one's trying to make a bad film or a bad TV show. Everyone's trying to do their best. It's just really hard to do it well. It's incredibly
hard.
Well, and
also with comedy, I mean, I've spoken to people about this on this show before. It's just the anger that people have when they think something isn't funny.
Right.
And I wonder where that comes from. I think personally it's because... fundamentally, I think every person thinks they know what funny is.
Right.
And that's why when something isn't making them laugh, because they think they know what funny is, they get angry about it.
Right.
Rather than going, oh, someone in the flat next door might be laughing at this.
It's just
like, how the fuck have they got the audacity to make this? Like, you know, my taxpayers' money. Or,
sure.
You know, they get so...
Well, I think it's also that you're very aware of how to judge comedy, right? Like, if you're not physically laughing, if the film that you're watching is not actually having a physiological impact on you as you watch it, you're feeling shortchanged. Whereas watching a drama, you're more inclined to kind of wait till the end to decide if it kind of moved you or you felt something. You know what I mean? That you sort of take that more as a holistic thing. Whereas comedy, you kind of want to laugh second by second, right?
Yeah, it's like drinking alcohol and you're not getting drunk.
Right.
Like, what's going
on? What is wrong with this? What is wrong with this cocaine? I am not getting a bus.
It's because you've taken too much.
I'm going to write an angry tweet to my dealer.
I did read somewhere recently there are people who sell drugs online, that they're right. Someone invented an app so that you can't trace where it's coming from, and you can order a dealer to go to that person's house. I'm not condoning.
Is this something that you're advocating? Is there going to be a kind of spoken word sponsor? Or you're going to interrupt this and
sponsored by cocaine to your door?
Right.
Was there something when you were younger? So you're a young Bristolian, is it? Uh-huh. You're from Bristol. Was there something that you watched that made that definitely made you go, "Oh, I want to do that"? Or
I think I was a fan for years, and I used to watch all those old black and white comedies with my dad, and I Love Lucy and those sort of shows. And then I think what started to turn it around for me was John Cleese, becoming a fan of John Cleese through Fawlty Towers and Monty Python, and then discovering that John Cleese had grown up in Weston-super-Mare, not far from Bristol, and had been a student in Bristol, went to a Bristol school, and then had gone off to the Cambridge Footlights. And I just, for some reason, I remember thinking, oh, he was born near here, he's tall, and that sort of somehow
he's me.
Well, exactly, exactly. And I just thought, oh, he did it. And it still seemed like a kind of crazy idea to me, but for some reason, I just felt like what he did, I might be able to do. Not that I thought I was as brilliant as him, but that, I don't know, he just seemed accessible, you know, in a way that almost no one else did.
That's interesting, because also he's from the kind of Oxbridge class as well.
Right, so. But then for a long time I would tell my teachers that I wanted to go to Cambridge University and to be in the Footlights, because I thought that was the career path. Yeah. And then my teachers at my school, my comprehensive, would say, you're never going to get into Cambridge, you won't get the grades. And so I never tried applying for Cambridge, and then I got the grades that would have been enough had I applied. And I always felt a bit angered by the fact that, again, it was that sort of, dare I say it, that British naysaying attitude of like, it doesn't happen to the likes of you.
Yeah.
You know, the again, I do think that probably if I was American, they'd have said, sure, shoot for the stars. You know, there might have been a little bit more of that.
You just need £500,000 to get
exactly,
in.
Exactly, exactly.
But there's a possibility, though, that had you done that maybe your life would have been,
well, I think in retrospect, it worked out okay, because like you say, I think
really?
What I meant was, I think that it would have made me perhaps into a sort of Oxbridge-y comedian, and I don't think really that's my bag. Like, because I am basically a working class oik in many ways, with pretensions.
Yeah.
And I think probably I'd have gone to Cambridge and been a bit overwhelmed by how smart everyone was, and that I thought I was clever in my school, but that actually I wasn't, and I think I probably would have been a bit overwhelmed and a bit intimidated. Maybe I'd have been. I just think it would have taken me longer to kind of tap into what I could do and what made me funny.
Yeah, and also your all your stuff, including right up to your most recent stuff, is much more low status,
right?
And kind of a bit more of the buffoon,
right? Right.
And you know, a lot of the, I don't mean to group them all together, but a lot of the Cambridge, Oxford type is a much more smarter, you know.
It's like there's a lot of wordplay and a lot of kind of, as you say, sarcasm and satire, and sort of seeing it from, as you say, a kind of high status, looking down on people's foibles, rather than, to me, kind of feeling like I'm one of the idiots.
Yeah, yeah. So it was definitely comedy you wanted to do from
always from a well, very early on. It was always comedy, and then I started seeing Woody Allen films.
Right.
And then I was like, oh, you can do comedy and you can do serious stuff at the same time?
Yeah.
And then that blew my brains out. You know, the idea that you could have both in one piece of work.
What was the Woody Allen film that
the one
got
that,
you in?
The one that amused me the most, like the first one I saw was Love and Death. What? And it was on late at night, and it was this kind of, you know, this sort of spoof of, you know, a Dostoevsky style earnest European film. And then I started.
Would you say that was still in his what they? Oh,
that's his early funny films. Yeah. But then, and I was just, I saw this like dweeby little guy kind of being hilarious, and again, it was a jaw dropping moment to me. Like, what is this?
Yeah.
I don't understand. Like, what? Who is this? He's wearing glasses from the 70s, but it's supposed to be in the 1870s. Like, what? And
you're like, it's me again.
Right.
But I'm both John Cleese and Woody Allen.
Yeah, well, that was it. I suddenly felt like I understood, oh, he's kind of awkward and he's nerdy and he's kind of got these hang-ups.
But smart,
and funny. And as a teenager, awkward teenager, I related to that. And also because he was very influenced by Bob Hope, who'd been my childhood hero. And so I could see these influences from that. And then I would start seeing things like Annie Hall and Manhattan, where there were jokes, but they were serious. And like, what? That just opened things up to me then. That was like hearing kind of indie music for the first time after you'd been on a diet of pop music.
What age were you?
That was early teens, probably.
Really?
13 or
That's
14.
That's really early to get into Woody Allen. I was very similar in that I grew up comedy-wise with like Rick and Aid and the Young Ones and just big in-your-face comedy. And then a bit more surreal in my mid-teens. I was like 20 when I first discovered Woody Allen. And it was actually through one of his non-starring, it was in Bullets Over Broadway, which just came out, and I was a big John Cusack fan. And he was having this new, having been in teen flicks, it was now in all these cool indies in the 90s. And I went to see it, not kind of really knowing it was a Woody Allen film, and I loved it so much.
Yes.
I was like, oh, maybe I should see his other stuff.
Yes.
And then the great thing about that was there was at the time like 20 something films to go, this back catalogue. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
All these things, and it was pre-DVD, so you really had to hunt the VHSs. Right. And
absolutely.
But that I was much later with that. I'm surprised that
early teens, because I remember I went from seeing those early movies to buying his stand-up tapes,
mm-hmm.
and his stand-up comedy, that just blew me away as well. I mean, just I was just down. And so he, and again, like with Cleese, thinking I had to do Footlights, when I became a Woody Allen fan, it was like, oh well, he did stand-up, so I should probably do stand-up, because mm-hmm. that's the sort of way that you pay your dues. Not realizing, of course, that as soon as Woody Allen no longer had to do stand-up, he turned his back on it immediately, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's why I started traipsing around doing stand-up, was sort of feeling like that was something you had to do to kind of earn your stripes.
I actually saw you do stand-up years and years. You did something, and maybe I'm misremembering this. You did, do you remember that show, The Stand-Up Show, that was on the BBC later, before stand-up became as mainstream as it is in the UK again?
Yes.
It was this little show filmed in front of like 30 people.
Yes.
That Barry Cryer or someone.
I think that's right, yeah.
And I remember seeing, I was in a sketch group at the time. And I was just a kid, just a little kid. And I remember seeing you, and it wasn't until years later that I suddenly, I'm sure it was that guy that did.
You saw me on TV, or no, you were in the audience?
It was a recording.
Yeah, because you see, the reason I was on was because my friend was a producer,
right?
And she said, "Do you want to do your act just so? Because we'll have the camera crews and we'll film it, and you can have it as a showreel." But it was never intended to be broadcast, so it was never shown. I just had it as a showreel thing. So you literally, unless you were in that audience, you'd never have seen it.
That's interesting, because I think we were the only sketch act that they ever put on there, and it was kind of a weird mix that I'm not entirely sure worked. But then did you not do stand-up for ages after you first started doing it?
No, I carried on. When you saw me there was one of the very early on, and then I carried on doing it infrequently. And then once The Office happened, that's when I stopped doing it, because I was just like, this is so much hard work. And you know, and
if Woody Allen didn't need to do it.
Yeah, and as soon as he stopped, he stopped. And then, so that I took a long time away from it. And then only more recently, in the last handful of years, did I go back to it.
Mm.
And again, I do think what I've realized is that doing it definitely sharpens you as a writer. I mean, I think it reminds you how to connect to an audience. It reminds you what makes an audience laugh, what doesn't, how audiences are both smart and stupid at the same time, by which I mean that they're informed and they're clever and they move quickly, but you still need to lead them by the hand through a sort of through certain jokes or setting up the premise of jokes. You know, there's a sort of technical side to it that you need to be reminded of, I think. When you're sat in a room on your own, you can kind of forget some of that.
I think when you've done stand-up for a while, your courage of convictions in a joke is stronger.
Because
you're like, I know this is the sort of thing that if I did it in front of a room of people, it would work.
Yeah.
That you do lose, that you don't. Do you enjoy stand-up? You haven't done a tour for a while.
I do enjoy it, but again, what's odd is I enjoy the mechanics of it. I really enjoy figuring it out. I find it very hard work and quite stressful, but I really like, you have an idea and then you really try and work it, and you work on it and you work on it, and eventually it works and the audience laughs. That I find really interesting. The idea that I then have to do that for another 200 times, that's less appealing to me. I don't have that urge to be on stage and to get the buzz of the audience and to sort of, you know what I mean? I don't feed off that. Yeah. I feed off the mechanics of how it all works, which is, I think, probably why I enjoy writing ultimately more than I do performing, and that I perform because it's a day off, I guess, from all the other hard work.
Did you, when you did The Office, how come you're not, you were not a regular character in there, and did you slightly regret not making yourself
up? Again, I think that's that thing when you look from the outside back at it, you think, well, he must have been desperate to be in it. But again, I think just from the way that it originated, it just never occurred to me. Like we were writing it, we were directing it, we were so densely involved with the producing and the editing that there was more than enough to do. You know, like it was so exciting and so all-consuming that I never, for one moment, was thinking, oh, I must, when do I get to be in it? You know, it never occurred to me. And if there was a bit that I could do that was useful, then I showed up. But, you know, I wasn't...
You showed up. You were there
already. Yeah, but I was already there. I mean, that's why I was in extras, was really because Ricky and I would be in the room writing and we would have this natural rapport that we developed, you know, over the years, and I was, I think, a pretty funny performer, and it was just like, well, I'm a resource, I'm gonna be on the set, we may as well stick me in it rather than casting the role. But, you know, it was driven less from ego and the desperation,
more from human resources,
just kind of I'm an asset, like why not use it.
Do you this is a weird question that people don't often like to answer, honestly, but do you like being famous? That wasn't part of why you were in the second series? Because I always get the impression when I see Ricky, and this isn't in any way, shape or form a criticism, but I get the impression he fucking loves being famous. Like, you know, it just, all the, like, when you see him do the Golden Globes or whatever, he just loves, like, you know, being up there, making those jokes,
right,
you know, rubbing shoulders with these people. In a really good way, in a sort of
infectious, well, I think he
way.
Has a performer's instinct. You know, he even before he was famous, he was the sort of funniest bloke in the pub.
Mm.
You know, and I don't mean that he was a show off. I just mean that he naturally draws people's attention. He just naturally draws the eye. He's just funny and smart and charismatic. And I think, you know, once he starts performing, it's just part of his makeup, you know, in a way that I don't think I have in quite the same way. I think I'm quite an accomplished performer, but I don't need it in my DNA. But in terms of whether I like being famous, I think I like the perks of it. You know, I think that's, someone said to me years ago, an interviewer in one of those kind of ways that The Guardian or some other broadsheet will try and psychoanalyze you when they interview you, or you read the article afterwards and they've made assessment, like, I noticed he looked away when I asked him this question, which tells, you know, they're kind of cod psychology. And this woman said to me, do you think that you went into comedy because it was a way of controlling when people laugh at you?
Wow.
And
it's a loaded question.
It was a loaded question, and I think there probably is some truth in that. And I think probably growing up, I did feel awkward and gangly and kind of out of place, and that humour was a way of, not that I was bullied, but it was a way of controlling my domain, if you like. And so consequently, I think fame is like an extension of that. Yeah. You know, it's sort of, it's that weird, freakishly tall, googly-eyed guy. Oh, from the telly, you know, and there's something about, if somehow you're legitimised in your in your oddness, you know?
Yeah, whereas if you weren't on the telly,
I'd just be the freaky boy from down the lane.
Yeah.
the local kids would like run and laugh at and throw rocks
at. I just love the way that that journalist worded it. It sounded so kind of, sort of passive aggressive, you know, rather than just sort of saying, did you want to be funny to like get people's, you know, win people's affections or anything. Right. It had this weird sort of like, I bet your life was shit until you were funny.
Right,
do you know what I mean? It's, I mean, I think it's pretty, you know, accepted that most comedians do it for that reason, regardless of what you look like. There aren't many beautiful, handsome comics.
I'm very suspicious of vanity in comedy. Yeah. You know, like comedians that are very good looking or take a great deal of pride in the way they look.
Yeah, except for Eddie Murphy.
How he managed to do that with the leather jumpsuit and the gloves and everything still be hilarious was weird.
And like 21 or whatever he
was. I don't know. He's extraordinary.
Why can't he? Like, I want him to do really interesting films.
He doesn't care. It's about just. I mean, he said it himself in the Inside the Actor's Studio. He says it's about money. I do it. You know, they asked me to be in Dreamgirls and the money wasn't good enough. And then eventually someone persuaded him. But I think he just. It's his choice. Yeah. He doesn't owe you anything.
He doesn't. And I nothing but respect, you know, do what you want. But for me, for my like personal enjoyment, I just know that he's got either another really brilliant, like when I saw Bowfinger, there was a performance where you went, wow, you're like an amazing character actor.
He's a great character actor.
But there's also, whenever I watch 48 Hours, which turns up on ITV4 at like 3 a.m. and that scene where he goes into the racist, this sort of the, you know, redneck bar, and you think this guy was about 20 or 21 then. He's a really good dramatic actor
But he's a good dramatic act, and what he is he's just exciting.
Yeah,
like you watch Beverly Hills Cop and you watch 48 Hours, and even now he's just exciting. Like there's an energy to him, there's a kind of electricity that's really thrilling.
Yeah,
and I think, but again, I think it's that we assume perhaps that, you know, if we had his talent, we'd want to be exercising in all kinds of interesting ways. And I guess maybe he just likes sitting at home watching movies or playing on his squash court or whatever he has. Ooh. And that everything else just to pay the bills. Like, you know what I mean? Like he just has a different pleasure from life than we want him to.
And he started so young that probably like
he's probably exhausted.
Yeah. Not everyone can be Daniel Day-Lewis, can they? And do like six, you know, film
years
every 6 years.
Preparation.
Well, look. Let's before we talk about your guilty pleasure, as you know, we get our guests to pick songs or a piece of score from films. Stephen, your choice. Do you have a song or a piece of score?
It's a piece of score, and it's, like I said earlier, I have pretensions, and that once I got into my teens, my sort of love of cinema kind of deepened and enriched, and by the time I went to university, I kind of studied film as an academic subject, and so therefore I like to think of myself as a cineast, if you will. And so therefore I often when people ask me about my favourite films or pieces of music, it sounds like I'm being pretentious because they don't assume that the guy who kind of will goof around on TV would necessarily, like, that I must be trying to be...
That you've picked something from the French New
Wave. Yeah, right, exactly. And that I'm just trying to sound clever.
Yeah. Although they had never had music in their films.
But that legitimately, there is a part of me that's kind of this pretentious wanker. And so
we encourage pretentious wanking on this.
So. Yeah, there you are. And so when you asked me about that, I thought the piece of music that immediately came to mind is this piece of music that runs throughout the Wong Kar Wai film In the Mood for Love, which I think is just a masterpiece of, dare you say it, world cinema. Why, for some reason, anything that's not American or English is considered world cinema, I don't know.
I love world cinema.
But anyway, it's... The film itself is majestic, and I don't know if you've seen it, but it just has. It's about this couple who are both married, and it's set in the '60s, and they kind of have this this unconsummated sort of love affair. It's just beautifully shot. I think it took Wong Kar-wai like 2 years or something, and he's kind of, you know, he's impossibly meticulous. The costumes, the set design.
Shooting the whole time for 2 years?
Pretty much. Wow. Because a lot of the people that work with him kind of can't bear to work with him again. Like, because it's so time consuming.
So there's changeover of crew every 4 months.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, it's just a majestic piece of work, but it has this piece of music, and I've had to make a note of it because obviously it has a lot of what I call world names. It's Yumeji's theme, which apparently was originally from the soundtrack of another film called Yumeji, but it's by Shigeru Umebayashi. I believe that's how you pronounce it.
Okay.
And what I love about it is it's, if you've seen the film, it is this kind of motif that runs throughout, and it's it's romantic, and it's sort of haunting, and it's melancholy, but there's a sort of optimism to it. Like it's just a really beautiful piece of music that when you see the film, just works in tandem with the images like perfectly. You know, it's just a great fusion of the pictures and the piece of music, and it's often accompanies the sort of lovers, you know, crossing in the street, or, and it's just, I don't know, it just, it's when you ask me about a piece of music, it's just the piece that immediately pops into my mind.
Could you introduce this, because I'm just worried I'm gonna say it, you know, I can't do world talk.
I'll just say it's Yumeji's theme from In the Mood for Love.
There you go, beautiful piece of music. I love the way you introed that as though you were on Capital or Gold, but with the kind of music you would never
you'd never hear on any of those radio stations. Yeah.
Last segment of the show, we always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure, a film that is either just downright shit, but for some reason they love, or they think is an underrated classic. What have you got, Steve?
I'm not quite sure this one slots into either of those camps exactly. I'm not one of those people that really subscribes to the idea of kind of it's so bad, it's good. Because on the whole, like, really bad films are just bad. And that I feel like there's so many great films that why am I rewatching a shit film? Yeah. You know. But there are certain occasions.
I agree with you. I've never seen a film that's, you know, those sort of B-movies from the 70s and 80s, maybe.
Right.
But I still wouldn't sit through the whole
thing.
You wouldn't sit the whole thing, right?
You'd see a clip of it and it would make you laugh, but anyway, this is a film which, and I'd be sort of interested, I don't know if you correspond with your listeners, but I'd be interested to know if anyone has watched this lately, and or maybe they watch it after our conversation and tell me whether it stands up in any way, because my memory of it, I haven't seen it for a long time, but at the time I remember watching it kind of at least 3 or 4 times in the course of a year or so, just being really amused and charmed by it. It was a film, it's from about 1998. And the reason I speak of it a bit vaguely is because, like I said, I haven't seen it since around that time. But at the time, it really, really stuck with me. It was starring Mark Wahlberg, and it was produced by John Woo and Wesley Snipes. And it's called The Big Hit.
Do you know, I don't even know.
You've not even heard of it, right? And a lot of people haven't. And it's it was directed by a Hong Kong action director whose name, I'm afraid, escapes me. And
was he like a protege of
I think he's a protege of Woo. And it's Wahlberg as a sort of lovable professional assassin. And it has a lot of the hyperkinetic shooting and editing style that you'd associate with John Woo and the Hong Kong.
And the kind of following a bullet.
Following a bullet, like that. Yeah. But it's probably relatively low budget. So, but it's well made, as in my memory, very, very of its time. And Wahlberg is a professional assassin. He has a mistress who's a headache. And then he's also engaged to Christina Applegate, who's a sort of Jewish princess, who's also very demanding. And I can't exactly remember entirely what the plot is, but there's lots of shooting and assassinating. But anyway, Arrival is played by a very pumped up Lou Diamond Phillips.
Oh, wow.
Which is great. So, and then it's an excellent cast. And anyway, what's great about it, it had that thing that a lot of sort of late 90s action movies has, is when the kind of indie vibe started to infect mainstream or commercial films. So, you know, like how in Con Air, there are all these odd little weird digressions that I'm sure was very influenced by the fact that, you know, Tarantino and people were very popular. And so suddenly every mainstream film, sort of, they injected it with a bit of this oddball humor. And
didn't they get people like Tarantino to do
do kind of a quick pass of the script, right? Yeah. So in this, you know, on the surface, it's a kind of action romp in which Wahlberg ends up kidnapping the daughter of this businesswoman. But the whole second half is sort of... And there's humor throughout. Like, it's not accidental humor. It's intentional humor. Yeah. But he's kidnapped this girl, and he's keeping her hidden in his house while his fiancé and her parents come to dinner for a sort of Jewish festival. And so all these antics of him having to keep this kidnapped girl hidden whilst Christina Applegate and her parents, the father played by Elliot Gould, have come for dinner... So that he's trying to keep. So there's all the kind of like Fawlty Towers farce of him trying to keep this.
Woody
she
Allen
keeps trying to
meets
escape.
John Woo.
Yeah. Right. Meanwhile, the other rival assassins show up, and he doesn't want to admit that he's an assassin, so he has to welcome them into dinner. So now there's this whole tense sequence where everyone's sat around the dinner table, but there are guns underneath the table, whilst Applegate and Gould kind of just argue and talk like. So there's like a family dinner with assassins. Meanwhile, there's a running joke that Wahlberg has an overdue video that he has to get back to the video store.
No.
And the guy from the video store keeps phoning him up, demanding the return of the video, and that the fee is going up and up. And so it culminates in this huge action set piece, which in my memory is excellent, with him being chased through a forest by a car, but him with the video trying to get the video back to the video store. And it's just... Anyway, as I say, it was. I remember it being funny. I remember it being kind of kinetic and sort of silly and overblown in the way that the best of those Hong Kong thrillers are, and that Wahlberg was incredibly charming, and that there was great supporting turns, everything over the top from these other good actors, and it just feeling like a romp, you know, just like it was fun.
I so want to watch this.
And
now.
I again, you might watch it now, and it might just be a mess, which I suspect is the case. Yeah. But at the time, I remember being really charmed by it. So I'd be interested to know whether it has any of those pleasures.
Well, I'm going to watch it, and I'm going to let you know as soon as I finish watching it. VOD and the internet has a lot to answer for, because, you know, it's ruined storylines about people trying to get videos back to Blockbuster.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
We can't do, you know, mobile phones and online streaming. That's it. It's ruined storylines.
Well, actually, it's funny. I saw Deadpool recently, and in a way, now that I talk about it, like a lot of the sort of playfulness of Deadpool, you could well imagine in Deadpool him having to get a video back to the video store while saving the world, like, you know what I mean, it's shot through with that same kind of fun humor. And I'm sure The Big Hit is wobbly, but anyway, at the time I was really charmed.
It's funny because the other one you were going to mention is Con Air, and so they were both a year apart, so there's something about that era of dumb action films that had that weird new, like,
Well, Con Air, again, but they were at their best, they were very overblown. Like, there's something very operatic about Con Air. I mean, it's preposterous, and you know, everyone is chewing the scenery.
I took it quite it's quite real, actually.
Well, I mean, you know, it's, I think for me what I love about it is, it's, you know, it feels like it's 2.5 hours long. It feels like it ends three times.
Yeah,
it has these huge set pieces. You know, John Malkovich is over the top. Nicolas Cage, everyone's chewing the scenery. Cage has that absurd haircut. There's all those great lines where, you know, he kind of kills a guy. You put the bunny back in the box, you know. And do you remember there's these weird digressions where on board is this serial killer played by Steve Buscemi who stops to have tea in a disused swimming pool with a little girl who weirdly lives in the middle of nowhere. Her family are not around. Her parents are not around. You think he's going to, like, kill her because he's a serial killer. He doesn't. There's twisted little jokes, and it just feels like someone at the studio said, you know, you have to have some Tarantino-y digressions and kind of weird, cool.
And it was when they started putting all this sort of indie darling actors in these, exactly.
So Buscemi's in there in Cage, and like you said, they've shipped those people in.
John Cusack, John Cusack. Malkovich.
Yeah. And yet, and it's just, and it's overblown and it's preposterous, but it's fun.
Yeah.
It's so much fun.
Have you seen it recently?
Yeah, I watch it when it comes, as soon as it comes on TV, I'm in. And I don't think it's, you know, to me it was absurd and over the top at the time. Anyway, another one I remember from that period similarly enjoying was The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that with Sam Jackson and Gina Davis?
Yeah.
Again, same sort of thing, like shot through with funny little asides, you know, great moment where early on she's just a domestic kind of housewife who doesn't remember that she used to be an assassin.
Yeah. It's a great...
And a guy kind of breaks in the house and she throws her kitchen knife at him and kills him and says to her husband... Her husband looks at him like, what were you doing? And she says, chefs do that. You know, it's just sort of... just, I don't know, they were just...
That was
Rennie Harlin. Yeah. But they just... for whatever reason, I feel like in more recent years, a lot of the blockbusters have sort of... They seem to have lacked some of that campy joyousness that those films from that period had.
I think you're right about the fact that it was off the tail end of that early 90s indie Sundance Miramax scene, and all those people were now moving away from that and working in, because I was looking at the guy who, because I was like, is Con Air, was it intentionally funny? A phrase you said earlier, which I thought
definitely
would be a funny genre. Yeah, I do comedy. What kind? Intentionally funny?
Right.
But I
definitely think it's intentional. But the reason I say that is because I think sometimes people dismiss those films as though the humour wasn't intended and that it's just corny.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not. It's clearly that's intended. You know, I mean, it's obviously intended to be funny. I mean, there's that great moment where... John Cusack's kind of rival FBI guy, his car, his much loved prized possession Porsche or whatever, is suddenly hooked by a cable that's attached to the plane, and it gets pulled up behind the airplane, and Cusack looks out the back of the plane and there's a Porsche being dragged through the air, and says, on any other day that would seem kind of weird. And it still makes me laugh, but again, you know, it's supposed to be funny.
I was trying to work out whether it was intentionally funny or not. I was looking at Simon West's CV, and he hasn't really done films with that sort of humour and kind of with that ever so slight left field touch in it. And then the writer, I was looking at his stuff, and he did things like Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead,
right?
Beautiful Girls. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was a brilliant film.
Again, they're very much of the indie 90s sensibility.
High
Fidelity
and
exactly.
So,
I mean,
so clearly when he got asked to write Con Air, he was like,
isn't it Bruckheimer?
Yeah.
You know, Bruckheimer, again, obviously a smart man who tapped into, you know, that. Because you remember things like, there's like Crimson Tide. I think Tarantino did a pass on Crimson Tide. So Tarantino added jokes and little bits of character detail to that. And then do you remember, is it Clement and Lafreniere? I think it's Clement and Lafreniere. Didn't they write on The Rock?
Yeah.
And they wrote extra jokes on The Rock. So, you know, those filmmakers obviously knew that it needed humour and it needed...
They were so overblown, weren't they? That you just made me, when you said
joyous.
The Rock,
oh,
just the music, all the
it's
like...
It's a blast, though. But it's just fun. It's just so much fun.
Can
you know?
Imagine making one of those where you've got a full choir and orchestra and you're like, so this guy's walking into a prison cell and then you just do every instrument and
right,
every
yeah.
It's like there's no subtleties here.
No
Let's
subtlety.
Just fucking go for it, man.
Right.
Well, I think
everything's dialed up to 10.
I think they're brilliant choices, and I definitely want to go and watch. What was it called?
It's called The Big Hit.
The Big Hit. I can't wait to watch.
Well, I look forward to finding out if it stands up at all.
Okay. I will let you know. Well, Stephen, thank you for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.